Hello and welcome to edition 381 of the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be meeting Danish chef and food writer Trine Hanneman. She'll be talking us through her book, Scandinavian Comfort Food, Embracing the Art of Hygge. And she'll be giving us a masterclass in what hygge actually means a little later.
We'll also be hearing from Xaver Ulbaum, co-director of a new film, Letters from Baghdad, telling the unsung story of Gertrude Bell, known by some as the female Lawrence of Arabia.
And we'll be meeting Susie Dent, the lexicographer whose new book, Dent's Modern Tribes, looks at some of the unusual language used across the British Isles.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be forming some barely coherent sentences in the news look ahead. We'll enjoy some music too, right here on Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. That was the week that was, Tom. Was it a classic on the Tedwards side of the Monocle Empire?
I would say it's in ballpark. Maybe not classic, but solid.
Yeah, solid.
Not legendary, but worthy of historical record.
What I'd like to tell listeners is that your diary is a piece of... Well, it's an interesting piece. It's an artifact, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm an inveterate doodler.
Yeah, so there's a lot of doodles in your diary.
That's not a euphemism or anything. I draw doodles whilst concentrating.
Yeah.
Because as I understand it, Rob, if you doodle, for example, during a telephone call, you actually digest, process and store the information to a greater degree of reliability. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
It's apparently very good for that.
So you must have sort of what would be the aural equivalent of a photographic memory.
this
famous diary that sits on your desk, how many things did you tick off it this week? Have you had a solid week?
Busy.
How many
things, yeah, okay. I mean, again, people who've seen the diary will know that I don't just tick them off, I really strike them out.
Yeah, when I was presumably learning to write, and still probably when I'm using a cheaper form of a biro or something, I kind of press too hard on the pages. I was always told I pressed too hard. Mm. It was basically like sort of braille the other side.
Some weeks I perforate it completely.
I was going to say, it's like using
several weeks at
a
time.
Pen knife.
It is.
Your pen, isn't it?
It is.
Okay.
Done with a flourish.
So that's good. Yeah. So lots of doodling, lots of stuff's
lots
gone
done.
Into the brain bank, lots of stuff ticked off. It's a solid week.
Same for you? Productive?
Fairly productive.
You seem a pretty fine fettle, I would say.
Really?
For a Sunday lunchtime, yeah. Not that you wouldn't be at that time of day.
We've got a packed show.
This is a really good show.
Let's usher him into the studio with, well, a piece of spam on the end of a bamboo cane. It's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you take this hop.
But how am I doing now?
I want to carry on talking a little bit about the diaries, because we're all issued with, listeners may not know this, standard issue Monocle diaries halfway through each year for the next year.
Yeah, you were really troubled when this happened.
Now,
they start in, I think, September, as good diaries do. But that seemed to provide you with something of a conundrum.
Maybe we can save that for another week. This week I want to focus on perforation within the diary, because in the bottom corners of each page.
I've seen that, yeah.
Do you know about this? There's a little triangle.
I use it every week.
Maybe you'll be able to answer my question. So I've begun removing those. You're meant to remove them, these little tags, to mark.
Oh, so you know
the
where
fact
you are.
That exactly.
So
and
you
I
can
need
leave,
that now.
You can leave through to the correct page immediately.
Correct. But which you've got, imagine, because it's two pages per week.
The facing page, I can never remember whether that's verso or whatever. The right-hand page.
That's what you rip
said
off.
Week. Yeah, okay. For me,
when it's 100%. When it's complete.
No, I do that as that week arrives.
So you're writing in Monday's column, and you look down to the bottom right-hand corner. You've already removed the
tag. That's gone.
Interesting.
What do you do with those little pieces of ripped-off paper? Do they help you to... Are listeners familiar with the word roach? Do people know? Is that what you use them for?
They're
I think it's too small. You could
store
they're
not quite, they're
you could
not,
store the year's worth and use them as confetti.
They don't quite have the weight for that, but I'm ashamed to say they're so small that I also don't afford them individual trips to the recycling bin at the end of the office. And I put them, they're the only bit of paper I put straight in the bin.
They're about the size of a little thumbnail, aren't they? A little fingernail.
Very, very small. A baby's.
Okay.
On the 23rd of October, Bill Murray will be receiving the Mark Twain Prize for American Humour, awarded by the John Kennedy Centre for Performing Arts. It's the 19th annual award. I think I talked about it last year when it was awarded to Eddie Murphy.
Okay.
This is going to give me an excuse to look back over Bill Murray's life and career. Are you
a big Bill Murray fan?
I'm a big fan of Bill Murray, yeah.
Go on, carry on.
What's your favourite?
It's hard to choose. I mean,
you're going Caddyshack, you're going Ghostbusters.
Well, yeah, I mean, growing up as I did, you know, the 80s was
the opening scene of Ghostbusters. So he's doing the memory cards thing. That's pretty good.
It's absolutely vintage. Yeah, I think that there's almost too many to choose from.
Some of his latter career work with Wes Anderson, particularly in 1998, Rushmore, was exceptional.
Yeah.
I am a big Bill Murray fan too, but he did that Bill Murray's Christmas, didn't he, last year, which I think was considered to be somewhat of a dip in an otherwise stellar career, which is a shame.
I think you're allowed a dip or two, aren't you?
I think, and also, what happens with awards? They only ever give you an award when you're sort of past your best anyway. Not mentioning Eddie Murphy in the same sentence as that thought, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, if you know, a bit like Bob Dylan, let's give him the Nobel Prize, you know, when he's sort of
hanging on by his fingernails.
You could have done it when he just made Street Legal or, you know, or Blood on the Tracks. But nah, let's do it 25 years too late.
Tina Fey was the youngest person to receive this prize in 2010, age 40. That's quite impressive, isn't it?
Because that's precocious.
A lot more to do. Bill Cosby turned down the prize for 2 years before accepting it on the ground that he was offended by the profanity used in the inaugural prize ceremony.
He pretending he didn't know what those words meant.
Apparently.
I can do them, but I can't say them.
Exactly.
So other people, unwillingly.
A certain irony.
Okay.
A certain irony now.
And this is all named after Shania Twain, am I right? This is great.
One of the real cultural titans, of course.
Totally. Okay.
Between the 23rd of October and the 25th of October 2016, the Gay and Lesbian Evangelical Fellowship will hold its autumn conference in Worcester. Now,
okay.
I don't want to talk about that event in particular, but I do want to talk about an issue which the existence of this event raises, which is the diversity within evangelical Christianity. And I know this is being held in Worcestershire, but I want to cross the Atlantic and look at the US now.
This is the silent sea in Worcester, the big sea of Christianity.
Precisely.
The twain shall meet.
Last week, the New York Times published an article. Donald Trump, I've got it in front of me, Rob, as a matter of fact, I printed it off.
Okay.
Donald Trump reveals evangelical rifts that could shape politics for years. I quote from the article. In nearly four decades since Jerry Falwell Sr. founded a group, Moral Majority, evangelical Christians have been the Republican Party's most unified and reliable voting bloc.
Really?
Yeah. But now they're splitting apart, particularly along racial and generational lines, where younger and less white evangelical Christians are not automatically supporting Donald Trump, who is the Republican nominee. And I just think that's interesting because it's particularly, I think, you hear on the part of liberals, Democrats, there is a tendency to think and talk about evangelical Christian voters as a homogenous mass. And let's be honest, the enemy, with a capital T and a capital E. And I think that a more nuanced view might behove us.
The Gay and Lesbian Evangelical Alliance, I may have got the name slightly wrong there, in Worcester. I mean, that would make some interesting discussions. It'd be intriguing to hear some of the kind of narratives, because that is to me, it sounds like trying to square a circle a little bit. But maybe I'm being naive, and some of the
I think call for this nuance. I think there's only one way to test this. I think this is a great outside broadcast, live from Worcester. Monocle 24, live from Worcester.
Yeah.
I know why I've put that accent. That's not how they talk in Worcester.
Where was that? That was kind of West Country, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, it's all ballpark, isn't it?
Cool. I like that. That's interesting and strange.
Thanks. Finally, on the 25th of October, Tuesday, the winner of the Man Booker Prize for Fiction.
Has that rolled around already?
Yeah, I know.
We've had some of the judges on this programme before, a few times actually, and that's always, I am always amazed at the amount of stuff they read,
It's crazy, isn't it?
They're
up at like into the quite a high number per day of books.
Yeah.
I just don't understand how that's physically possible.
On a good year, I might get through 10 to 15 books. And that is really, I'm on a roll there. Where do you find that? Do you know what I mean? I don't understand how they... And also, do you think that they're reading... do you think an author whose book is read at, for example, 3 a.m., is being prejudiced against by the circadian rhythm of the judge?
That's a good question. One of those things, you know, if a book's good enough, then it breaks through, isn't it? I suppose that's the idea.
It breaks through the fog. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, essentially, the fog of words. You know, something really wonderful, fresh, new, deep, exciting.
You could argue
visionary.
It stands out in an all the more striking way if it's one of 100. It will be like laser burned into your eyes.
Yeah. Have you ever judged a literary prize, Rob?
No.
You strike me as the kind of person who, well, of the three of us, is at least most likely to be invited to judge one.
I think I managed to get through more than 10 books a year, but
that's
encouraging. I don't think I could handle the
because it's the pace how many?
Of
that. It's in the hundreds, isn't it, that they need to read within a very short spread of time.
I think it's a good job for someone, but it has to be your job. You have to be a publisher
or
an editor
exactly.
or someone. I don't think you couldn't do this
and
job.
Is it like jury service? Do they get like pay? Do they still have to continue doing their jobs? I don't understand.
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah,
but where Rob's right. If you are a critic or a publisher, you are reading probably 3 books a day.
Mm.
In the matter of your general
you're
employ,
zooming through
so it's less of a
and
imposition.
I don't know who's going to enter. All I've heard is our mutual friend John Mitchinson, who comes and does the arts review sometimes, and the culture show sometimes. Erudite man with good taste, and a publisher himself. He's put all of his weight behind Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad this year. It's the sort of like the best book he's read in 20 years, which is kind of an amazing thing. I think now that the Booker is open to British and overseas authors, I think Colson Whitehead must be in the running for that. Anyway.
Has that been a game changer?
I think it's been a game changer. I think that's what they call it. Yeah. Like the Underground Railroad would be in any major urban area. You know, it's convenient.
It changes commuting times, if nothing else.
I love the news look ahead, Henry. I mean,
thanks,
we kind
Rob.
Of went from ripping off the small bit at the bottom of your diary pages to more meaty things like Worcester.
I try to capture the fullness of the complexity of human experience every week.
Oh, God.
That could be part of a new jingle for you, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you reckon that can be put into verse?
I'm just hearing that it definitely can
And be. set to a jaunty... Ad
bed.
Do a jaunty bed.
Well, let's see. I'm Henry Sheridan. Thank you very much. Trine Hanneman is a Danish chef and food writer currently helping spread the cultural practice of hygge further afield. Hygge basically means cozy in Danish, and Trina's new book, Scandinavian Comfort Food, Embracing the Art of Hygge, allows cooks to get very comfy with the concept.
But making things a little more hospitable translates beyond Danish culture alone. Trina's also been working on a project with Syrian refugees to raise money for the Danish Refugee Council. But she joins us now on the Monocle Weekly to talk about hygge and about the new book.
When we were told that there was a chef specialising in the art of hygge, Scandinavian comfort food, coming in, Tom and I basically thought we wouldn't have any lunch or breakfast, so we're slightly disappointed that all it is a book.
I can see that, yeah.
But this is something which is fantastically timed as we come into the autumn and winter months.
Yes.
But we have to kill a few darlings on this show, as we know, so we have to be a bit... So which are the ones that you were going to... Which are the ones which you would have brought in to the radio if you wanted to give us prime hygge in food form? What would be the one that you'd have brought in today?
I think the Skipperlapskaus, which is like...
I'm blushing because I know what that really means.
Which is like, I think, quintessential comfort food when it comes to Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mash and meat and some garlic and some onions and bay leaves that's been boiling for like 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so we've got a bit of reduction in there.
Yes.
And we've got some kind of the solid key components of winter food in there as well.
And some
fat. I can hear Tom's tummy rumbling.
That's my stomach. Excuse me, everybody.
Other side of the studio.
Yeah.
And I wondered, obviously, it's interesting, there's quite a few books and there's been a lot written actually about hygge, about this notion recently. To your mind, and obviously food is really front and centre in it from your perspective, Is it about food first, or are there these other things which are, you know, sort of tangential? It's about attitudes and a way of living, or do you think it all comes down to food in the end?
Both yes and no, but because I think everything comes down to food.
ultimately, yeah.
So therefore, yes. But hygge is embedded in Danish culture in a way that it even makes it difficult to explain, because it's something that we take very seriously. But it's there all the time. It's about, we use it as we say, hyggeligt. It's about having a hyggelig time, more or less all the time. And we use it
to misquote Spinal Tap. Yeah, okay, I like that.
And so we kind of, you know, aim for it every day, and we use it in our language every day. We don't say nice. We say when we had dinner with somebody, we would say that was very hyggeligt, and not that was very nice.
If it was a nice meal, presumably.
Yes. Yeah. But
Why do you think it's such a peculiarly? I guess it's a Scandinavian thing, but the Danes in particular are very, very specific about what it means. Why do you think it is so particular? You know, we're not a million miles away here in the UK, and yet we don't have this idea. Why is it just that body of water between us? Or
I think it's about the culture of home culture, you could say, about being at home, about the home being the center of your life, eating meals with friends at home, with your family, with, you know, we live at home. We don't live outside our, you know, flats and houses. And going to restaurants with friends is actually new. You know, even though, you know, Copenhagen is this new...
Well, now it's the center of the world,
Yeah. When it comes to restaurant. This, you know, has happened over the last 10, 15 years. And before that, I mean, you know, even though I'm not that old, but I don't really go to restaurants with my friends. It doesn't happen. It's not what we do. We do dinner at home, lot of candles, make sure... I mean, it's very important that your home is a place of hygge. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the biggest compliment somebody can say to you, is that your home is hyggelig. So it's you know, it's so much part of me that sometimes I feel it's difficult to explain, because it's what it is.
Because it's second nature.
Yeah, kind of.
And is this a generational thing as well? Did you learn it from your mum, Trina? Is this something that kind of comes through the family? Is it also predominantly a female thing? And I wonder if that's changing as well.
No. Okay. Because the interesting thing is that going to what is a Danish
pub...
So log
chopping and bread slicing is... Okay.
But even going to a football game could be hyggeligt if the beer was nice and there was, you know, good sausages. And so it can also be outside the home, but it comes from, you know, that base of trying always to get the best out of everything. I think Danes are really aiming for that.
That is truly amazing, because I was just thinking, I've been to quite a few football games in this country. Definitely, I would describe them as almost everything except that. So if you can achieve it at a football game, that's pretty good going.
You know, the Danes were very famous for being the calm people at football games 20 years ago when we won the, you know, whatever, European Championship. Yeah. We were called something like the calm people. In Danish.
it's a bit like being in the White Hart Lane, isn't it?
Very much so. A little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't even try and describe someone as that. I'd probably get a clip around the ear.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder, I mean, as a chef and as a cookery writer, Trina, do you notice, is there a bit of a standoff at the moment between the sort of haute cuisine, the kind of the foragers in Danish cooking, and the hyggers? Or are they all one big happy family?
I think they're pretty happy family, because I actually think hygge is...
I'm trying to get some leverage in there. It's not going to happen, is it?
But I think actually Norma, which is like the top restaurant, one part of their success is hygge.
Is that,
It's very cozy. You know, wooden tables, you have a reindeer skin in the back. And Rene Redzepi, he was one of who, you know, started saying to the chefs, you have to go down and serve your food you just cooked and talk to people. You know, make it... Danes do not like hierarchy. They like things to be equal, that we're all kind of at the same level field here. So therefore, going to a restaurant is also something that can make us uncomfortable if it's not hyggeligt, if we don't feel that the waiter could be our friend.
Right.
We don't like that. So I think restaurants try to achieve that in some level as well. But if you went to a very formal dinner and you were leaving, you would say that was not very hyggeligt.
Oh, if it
was one way
starchy.
Yes,
starchy and like really, I would almost say a little bit French maybe. But
yeah. Well, there is a certain amount of that formality. I've been to quite formal occasions in Sweden and things. And there is quite a formality to that, depending upon the sort of person that whose society you're in, I suppose. That's not a Danish thing then, or is that a kind of certain thing, or is that why you have to drink so much schnapps?
Yeah,
I just think in a snobbish environment.
Yeah, you pointed at it because the Swedish thinks we are anarchists.
Okay.
So, and they come down to, you know, let themselves loose in Denmark.
Okay. Yeah.
Now and then, you know. So yeah, we're not very good at formal.
Now, it's interesting. Obviously, we're talking about some countries which are separated by just a bridge or a small body of water. Do you think then these ideas are exportable, because obviously what's great about the book, there's a celebration of so much delicious food that just on its own, you know, the recipes, positively, the pictures are wonderful. I mean, it's mouthwatering just to leaf through.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we know that food and great writing about food travels well.
Yeah.
But this concept, does that travel well? I mean, if it went transatlantic, do you think it would, can it find a ready audience, do you think, wherever it goes, the notion of hygge?
I really think we need some hygge, especially on the other side at the moment. So, I also think the reason why hygge has become so, you know, something that is talked about is because of that whole looking to the Scandinavian countries right now about we are the happiest people, we got something right around the welfare state. And I actually think all these things are linked together, that we, you know, it's socially acceptable in all the Scandinavian countries to leave work around 4 or 5 o'clock and pick up your children, go home and cook and have a good time. That doesn't mean you're not going to sit down and work at the computer when the kids are asleep and work from 9 to midnight or something. But that whole idea that there's some point of the day where we take out 3 or 4 hours to do something with the people we love and care for. And that is also where hygge comes in. And I think a lot of people in now, right now, where things are a little bit too, you know, crazy and people work too much and they feel on pressure, they all think that's a pretty good idea.
I'm feeling inspired already.
I'm going to leave it in a minute. Exactly. Yeah. And is it how old is hygge? Because I have an idea that it is a candlelit Inglenook fireplace sort of lit kind of thing that, you know, stretches into the mists of time.
Yeah.
But I bet it isn't. I bet it's something that's kind of new. I mean, I'm kind of thinking that we finally all got our kind of modernist hats on, our kind of Scandinavian design hats on. We all kind of like to live in the nicest room in the house, and that tends to be the kitchen. I'm looking, by the way, at a 5-grain bread here. I'm going to have to turn the page. It's essentially pornography. And I wonder whether it's actually quite a new thing. I wonder whether you have a sense of it.
I think in about 100 years.
Yeah. Okay. So, and have Danes always, you know, say the middle class Dane, has that family always lived around their kitchen, around the stove, more than being served in a dining room, I wonder?
I think after the Second World War, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where, yeah. That's also where we kind of built the middle class. Yeah. Then, you know, family meals have been a very important part of everyday culture. But of course, the kitchen where we're all sitting in, that didn't happen until the 80s, where it became very fashionable, you know, in every country to have we call it a conversation kitchen or a talking kitchen or whatever. And
even that is interesting, because in this country it's just called an eat-in kitchen.
Okay.
I.e. there's a table there.
Okay.
But
okay,
it's a conversation kitchen. There's a degree of enlightenment reflected.
Yeah, right. There is. So it's nice to be nearer the fridge.
Yeah.
Right? Or the wine rack.
What do you do in here? Cook and eat.
Eat in.
And it's like, oh, we have a conversation, but it's obviously just us Danes.
Just us Danes. And what about the drink? I mean, there's a Christmas section in your book as well, Gina. I mean, this Christmas is none more hygge time, I suppose.
Yeah, that's like...
So that's kind of classic hygge.
Yes.
Can you have too much hygge at Christmas even?
If you ask my husband, he would say yes.
Oh, really?
Yes. He would say, you want to take it down a notch.
He's out having a cigar in the garden.
No, just, a bit of anti-hygge would do.
Anti-hygge.
Yeah.
Well, how does it work in the summertime, I wonder? Because that's kind of, you know, there's obviously a lot of Scandinavian summer traditions and all the rest of it as well. Can you have a hygge time in the summer, or is that a little bit more free and easy?
No.
Can you be a bit more French in the summertime? God damn it.
No, not really, actually. You go to the summer, to your beach houses and lots of, you know, colourful blankets, and as soon as it starts to be twilight hour, you lit the candles and be up all night drinking white wine or rosé and, you know. I think Danes are really aiming
at... We've got some agreeable pictures.
Got any passports?
But just on that point, it's funny. Our Monocle's correspondent in Copenhagen, Michael Booth, I don't know if you know, he wrote a book looking at the mythology of Scandinavia.
Yeah.
And obviously he was being a bit of a contrarian, a bit controversial. But he was saying, look, maybe it's not quite all it's cracked up to be. And I guess that idea of hygge comes into that. Is that very much an outsider writing? Or are there some people who say, maybe this isn't the way?
No, I think he has a good point there. And I'm going to refer to my husband again. He would agree more with him. Because he thinks it can be, I mean, a lot of people think it can also be a pressure. Like, we're all sitting now here around the table.
How hygge are we today?
Now it has to be hygglet, you know.
Yeah.
Right now, let's hygge. And that's...
Hygge pressure.
Hygge pressure, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And do you think maybe...
So there's a social norm.
And do you think younger people maybe are they more affected by that pressure, do you think? Or might they be, you know, the next generation or two? Might they say, you know, it's too expensive to do this, and it's what our parents used to do. We need something different. Could that change? Could that be a threat to it?
Yeah, but also young people are much more part of that restaurant culture that we have now. Mm. And but I think it will be difficult to change the whole idea of sharing food and drink as a way of being together, which is such a big part. I mean, when you visit somebody in a Danish house, you don't, you know, you open the door and you would, in many countries, you say, how are you? We don't say that. We say, hi, would you like a cup of coffee? That's the first thing. Yeah. It's like, and Danes like to, you know, they don't like too direct questions right away. So I think also the whole idea of putting that hygge in between.
There's also the nature that a Dane will be honest, right? Yes. Saying, how are you? Yeah. I'm absolutely splendid, thank you.
Yes.
When, you know, your arm's hanging off or something. Or, you know, you clearly are bereft. That's a funny thing, because that's the
really
Scandinavian
funny.
Honesty. Yeah. You have to skirt around the honesty or expect to be given a wrong answer. Like you often
are. Yeah, we don't understand the how are you if you don't really are asking me.
Yeah.
So we ask each other, would you like a cup of coffee? And
okay,
that's
it's
it.
Easier. A diversionary tactic.
Yeah. Everyone in this country would just say, yes, fine. Yeah. So you've learned nothing either way, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Before we go then, let's do a bit of prime hygge scoring.
Yeah.
I'm going to go through your book and I'm going to find maybe three or four of your recipes, of the dishes in here. And you can give us a hygge score out of 10. 10 being the most hygge.
Yeah.
Zero. Being
None.
French.
French, yeah.
okay, so here we go. This is called, you call this your childhood favourite winter stew. It's called Labskovs, and it's basically chuck steak.
This is going to be hard.
Chuck
isn't
steak,
it, sure.
Floury potatoes. It's like almost like a thick pottage.
Yes.
Your hygge score out of 10, Trina.
10.
Okay.
No doubt.
Okay.
Straight in. Good pick, Rob.
This
Good
is
pick.
Called Burning Love. It's a Sweden carrot mash, beautifully presented on a plate. Looks quite contemporary. Trina's hygge score out of 10.
10.
Wow, okay, all right.
A trend is developing.
A trend is developing here. What about Nordic tomato soup with rye? Looks beautiful there. You've got a bit of delicious rye bread to stick into it. Hygge score out of 10, Trina?
8.
8, okay. Should we go to the pudding section at the back? I mean, this.
Yeah.
I showed you this, Tom, before. This is called Kringle.
I can't keep looking
I don't actually really
that.
Know what Kringle is. It's described as a very classic Danish cake with yeasted dough.
Yeah.
You eat it for breakfast on special occasions. Oh, my God, I can't even
so
look at it.
So that's like a breakfast cake, in essence.
That's literally
making
me go
nuts.
Or
we can also, in the afternoon, have it.
Breakfast or afternoon cake. It's a cake for all seasons.
It is. So this is Kringle. Trina, your hygge
score
out of
10. We're back at 10.
We're back at 10.
I love Kringle.
I'm going to try and find something that doesn't look very hygge to me. Okay, lemon mousse. It's called citron fromage. You've even got it in French there.
Yeah,
your hygge score out of 10.
That's an old tradition to name things.
In French.
In French. I think we're going to... A 9.
Nine!
Still a 9.
Yeah. It's a good
Even
game.
It's a bit French.
It's pretty good stuff. It's good. We're ripe for a game. They're very usable recipes, I think.
Thank
and
you.
It looks like a cookbook that will be lovingly battered and dog-eared in kitchens all over the world.
So.
If it has any of the sort of success it deserves to. Trina Hanneman, thank you very much indeed for talking us to embracing the art of hygge, Scandinavian comfort food. I think it's going to be a Christmas hit.
Thank you very much, and thank you for a hyggelig time.
Time for some new music now. We've just been talking about Danish cooking, and let's hear from a Danish band from Copenhagen. This is Marching Church with Heart of Life.
My delusions, the treasures of a listed life, make the resemble paradise of times. In the wilderness, directions lost while discovery tests new visions in the wild.
The sounds of Marching Church there, out of Copenhagen with Heart of Life. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week. With me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
When it comes to the historical figures who helped shape the 20th century, Gertrude Bell might not be a name you're familiar with. And that's something of a scandal because Bell, born in the UK in 1868, helped shape the Middle East as we know it today. She travelled widely in Arabia, worked for British military intelligence during the First World War, and even helped draw up the borders of Iraq. For those in the know, she's often referred to as the female Lawrence of Arabia.
The story of Bell is now the subject of a new documentary from Ziva Erlbaum and Sabina Krayenbuhl named Letters from Baghdad. The voice of Oscar winner Tilda Swinton assumes the identity of Bell, whose lifelong commitment to letter writing helped the filmmakers understand her story. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Ziva Erlbaum, but first let's hear an excerpt from Letters from Baghdad.
I prefer the east to the west. Its sights and its sounds. In the desert, every newcomer is an enemy till you know him to be a friend.
We believe she's a British spy. Her travels should be prevented.
Thank you very much for joining us, Ziva. You're here to talk about your new film, Letters from Baghdad, which is... it's about a very special woman in history, really, Gertrude Bell. But it's someone that I hadn't heard of. I wouldn't be surprised if many of our listeners haven't heard of. And that's maybe one of the reasons that this film is being made, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about who this woman was and why her achievements are so substantial and why we should all know more about who she is?
Yes, she is sometimes referred to as the female Lawrence of Arabia. But actually, she was very influential and much more influential than he was. And she went out into the Arabian desert in the early 1900s and formed relationships with the tribes and learned all of the tribal dialects and was then recruited by British military intelligence after World War I to help reshape the modern Middle East.
The Middle East today, I mean, people have misunderstandings about the culture there even now, and you know, with what's going on over there at the moment with the destruction and the horrific things, I mean, it's no secret that there is a sort of a cultural disconnect, I guess, between East and West. Was the Middle East that she was inhabiting, I mean, did it share the same challenges then as it did today?
Well, the thing that was so incredibly interesting for us was when we started to look at the archival footage from the period, we came onto this whole world that Gertrude Bell loved of a vibrant tapestry of lots of different people. And it was so in contrast to the images that we've grown to expect from the media. The Middle East was a completely different place.
Just watching the film, I mean, because obviously, I mean, there wasn't a lot of moving image back in those days. I mean, I don't know whether it's kind of been slightly massaged from later footage, I'm not sure, or whether it's all period. But even watching that, just some of the locations that her own photographs and just the other photographs that are in there, I was watching it and I was thinking, like, I could just watch this as a slideshow. I wouldn't even need a narration. All the images are stunning. And when you look at places like Baghdad, it looks like this really buzzing oasis of cultures and people. And I mean, there's no doubt that it is still that, but it's obviously so dilapidated and been so torn apart by war in recent years. I mean, she inhabited the Middle East at a time of war herself, but before the West started wading in there and messing around with it, did a lot of those countries kind of get on better, do you think? Do you think they were making their own way much more effortlessly than with this kind of strange interventionist hand that we're always tempted to maybe dive in with?
Sure. You touched upon one of our early challenges in making the film. Just to go back to that for a second, we were really uncertain as to how much archival footage and visual material we would end up with because we were very focused on making sure that everything was period. And so we were looking for footage from 100 years ago, from Baghdad and Cairo and Damascus and Tehran. And we were so delighted after working on the film for more than 4 years. We have amassed an incredible archive. And it's through that archive, which has really allowed us to see how the Middle East was at that time. And certainly the British after World War I, in imposing sort of an artificialness to the shape of the countries in the Middle East, started to reconfigure things in a way that was not ideal in terms of having people live side by side, which they had been doing for centuries.
And the way that people knew about Gertrude's work at the time, I mean, would anyone have known about? I mean, there's newspaper reports in the film and you know, there's archive stuff, because it feels like she's been sort of almost written out of history in a funny way. I mean, were people aware at the time of what a sort of important figure she was for definitely the British and the British military? Was it being told back home, that story?
Yes, absolutely. Our film is based on primary source material. So not only did we base it on her letters to her family and friends, which are over 1,600, but we really scoured through archives to find letters that she had written and also letters about her, memoirs about her. And at the time when she was alive, she was very prominent and she was referred to as the most powerful woman in the British Empire, in fact. And it has only been after her death that she was slowly sort of written out of history in the way that the men that she served with in the colonial office, when they did their memoirs and when they wrote about their experiences, they slowly eliminated her from that history. And what was really fascinating for us is that we could see through the primary source documents of all the meetings and the dinners and the events and everything that she attended and that she made an impact on. And when we would read her colleagues' accounts of those meetings, she was nowhere to be found in the lists of the people that attended.
Do you think that because she operated in a very similar area and in a very similar kind of area of discipline, do you think that the story of Lawrence of Arabia, he had a nickname, right? Lawrence of Arabia, rather than boring old T.E. Lawrence. And in a way, that's almost easier for the public to grab onto, in a sense. And do you think that sort of gung-ho, rip-roaring image of his was so giant that it was almost kind of like, well, there's this other woman and she's also done equally amazing things, but people were just like, well, we've got one. We don't need another. Do you know what I mean? Do you think there's a bit of that going on as well as the discrimination, the sexism? It's kind of, there might not at the time have been enough room in the public's imagination for two people doing the exact same thing almost, and not identically. But do you get what I'm saying? There's two narratives going on.
Yes, absolutely. Well, T.E. Lawrence had Lowell Thomas, who was the original person who documented him and thought he was a great character for a slideshow way before David Lean. And certainly the legend of T.E. Lawrence really overshadows everyone else in the colonial office. So I think that is definitely part of it. And I also think that the fact that she was a woman had a big role in her not being acknowledged.
Yeah, of course.
The thing that's really fascinating is that in Iraq, we know from many of our advisors and people involved with the film, she is regarded very affectionately in Iraq, even as she is very much forgotten in other parts of the world.
That was Tom Hall speaking to Zeva Erlbaum, who along with Sabina Krainbuhl is behind the new documentary Letters from Baghdad. And you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, in the UK, one game show has dominated the afternoon TV schedules for the past 30 years. It's called Countdown, a game in which contestants try to form the longest word out of a collection of random letters. For many of those years, the scholarly authority sat in Dictionary Corner, judging whether those words are up to standard, has been Susie Dent, and she's up to the job. A lexicographer and etymologist, Dent has made language her life's work.
And language is the subject of Susie's new book, Dent's Modern Tribes, The Secret Languages of Britain. It's a collection that looks under the surface of the English language and delights in the unusual phrases, dialects and slang found among it up and down the nation. She joins us now. Susie, welcome to the programme.
Hello, thank you.
Congratulations on what is the most amazing idea for a book. I wish I'd done it myself.
Oh.
Tell us actually where the idea came from. It seems like a very obvious first question, but were you hanging out with a number of scaffolders, footballers or football commentators or maybe people that worked in the media industry and thought, why do you always all sound the same? What was the genesis
of it? Yeah, I think Well, first of all, I've been eavesdropping on people, which is essentially what this book is about,
yeah.
all my life.
A healthy
preoccupation.
Ever since
I was little. Yes. And when you're little, you're allowed to, aren't you? You're allowed to just sort of yeah. look at people and stare and things. And then I had to be a little bit more surreptitious about it. But I think it really struck me when I was on the TV studio floor. See, that's on the floor might mean something entirely different to somebody else. But in other words...
like it's not a boxing ring.
Yeah, exactly. yeah. So I'm in the studio and I hear down my earpiece, you're looking very hot. And I was delighted by this. Not something I get told every day. And it took me 6 months to realise later that what they meant was I was looking very shiny. So if you're hot on the floor, it actually means that you need a bit of powder. so I was very disappointed. And I thought, you know, there's so much TV jargon, and that's the tribe that I'm obviously immersed in, that nobody else would understand. And sometimes we just don't even stop to try and decode them because it's not really our world. But I think these words and phrases tell us so much about the people that use them.
Well, Susie, I wanted to ask you about that because I used to work in newspapers, and there's a section in there about all of the kind of weird, esoteric, arcane language there.
Yeah.
And I never really realised it at the time, and a sort of wave of nostalgia came over me. So researching the book, do the people who are in these tribes, do they really know they're in them?
I think that's a really good point, actually, because talking to paramedics, for example, I was quizzing them about their language, and one thing I found... in fact, with almost every tribe I interviewed, and it was the same with paramedics, was if you say to people, what's your jargon? They'll almost always say, we don't have one, you know. And literally, that was the response I got all the time, and I thought, this is going to be a very short book. But actually, if you tune in and listen in when they're just talking amongst themselves, that's when you catch it. So the best time to catch tribal conversation really is when it's not looking. And their shorthand is quick, it's expedient, but it's instinctive. They don't really know they're using it. So if they say, we're bluing in a patient ETOH, that means they've got the blue lights on and there's a patient who's drunk too much, essentially, alcohol poisoning, and they're coming straight in. But as I say, that's something that is just for them second nature, and they really don't question it. Where it becomes a very conscious thing is when secrecy is paramount. So in the military, I interviewed some Freemasons, spies, for example. That's when it's a deliberate code, and then they probably can tell you a bit about it, you know, consciously, because they're aware of it, very much aware of it.
And did you interview people and find that they dragged their jargon into their home life, into their sort of social life in a bit of a way as well, that actually they realise that they're talking sort of they're giving people the 1,000-yard stare in a kind of linguistic sense, or they're yeah. speaking over the top of someone's head, and they're like, hang on, what on earth are you talking about?
I think we all do that, actually. But we're really good at picking our audience most of the time. So, for example, I scull sometimes on the river, and so if I've really mucked up a project, I will simply say I've caught a crab, which in sculling terms means you've dug your oar far too deeply into the water, which I do quite often,
okay.
and you almost become a cropper. And capsize. And if you are a runner, you might say, if you're absolutely exhausted, I've bonked, which again is very puzzling for other people, if anyone knows that British expression.
Context definitely everything.
Yeah, something.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think we are all members of many, many tribes, and we all bring in our vocabulary, and actually some of it slips into the mainstream. So if you take pilots, for example, we talk about flying by the seat of our pants, we talk about pushing the envelope.
Chops away.
Exactly. Yeah. Lots and lots of expressions that now are, you know, very much mainstream. But in some areas, they do very much stay with the jargon.
So what does it take for that process to happen that way around, to go from the language of the tribe into the mainstream? And obviously, there's a great section about football and all of the crazy football jargon. But something like back to square one, say, which is an old football idiom, as
is
I understand it. Well, I believe it comes from this.
Yeah, the
grid. I never know if that's actually true or not.
There's no proof of it. Oh. It's a lovely, lovely story, and maybe one day we will find
get to the
actual
bottom. I always tell people that's literally true, which is there was a numbered grid, so if you were listening on the radio, you could tell where the ball was on the pitch. And if it went back to square one, it went back to, because that's where the keeper was.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's probably not true.
Maybe.
Those kind of things, they get purchased, and then people use them in other walks of life. Is it that something that just sounds right? Is it about the cadence of the language? What makes something get a wider usage?
I think it's, first of all, it's about the currency of it. So enough people use it, like all words, it'll you know, get out there, because English is entirely democratic. Got no academy saying you can use this or you can't. But also, these kind of things are cool. You know, if you want to sound like a pilot and you want that kind of charisma, customer, you might start picking up, of course, you might start picking up their jargon. Less so with cabin crew, which is strange, because cabin crew, perhaps not quite so glamorous. Well, you know, that's debatable, but certainly what they do is pretty hard work, and they have their own lexicon, which stays very much with them, but they will use it, you know.
I'd love to know the private one.
Right? Yes, passengers. Throughout the book, I have to say, customers are the number one requirement for secrecy, whether it's waiters talking about being stiffed by a flea, you know, somebody who's a poor tipper, in other words, or down to, I don't know, even personal trainers. They've all got their own code for pesky customers.
I dread to think some of them.
Yeah, right.
I'd probably, you imagine all the occasions when you might have been so accused in the past. Yeah.
There's a wonderful one, which I think a lot of people might find quite useful. And this was told to me by a fantastic paramedic called Luke, who said that whenever they are being told off in the ambulance crew by somebody from middle management or senior management or just somebody that they don't really approve of, they will simply say, "There we are then." And you take the first letters from "There we are" okay. then, and that spells out exactly what they think the person talking to them. So I think that could be very useful in everyday life.
It's good. It is a
I'm
good
gonna
tip.
I'm going to start rolling that one
yeah,
out.
Yeah, there we are then. And presumably with trades, I mean, trades come and go. And their language comes and goes as well. Are there trades that are dying out, the language of which you would like to protect, or maybe there is a trade that no longer exists, but we use one of those phrases or some of the idioms in our everyday speech?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly, in terms of old technologies, there are lots of words that still persist in daily use. So talking about journalism, we've got cliche, stereotype. Those both go back to actual physical...
They're two of the pillars of our magazine, actually.
Yeah, and mine too. But very often... as I say, the technology is completely outdated, but we hold on to those particular words. Spiking a story, you know, that looks back to that physical spike that editors would pierce their paper on quite violently. So those still persist. In terms of lost languages, I think one that's not in the book, but that I would love to research more fully, is pitmatic, which was a vocabulary that was unique to miners. And of course, mining has faded away very sadly in our country, in Britain. And hence the language is dying out. But entire villages would use this as a sort of tribal community language, and it bound them together. It was their sort of unique identifier, and it was homely, cheerful banter, but it was entirely theirs. And I'd love to look at that more.
Is there something exclusive? And there's something exceptionally inclusive about this. If you're in the tribe, you can speak this language with fluency. Is there something exclusive about it, pointfully so, to exclude people that can't speak it? Maybe it's your middle manager, or maybe it's an invading horde, or there are obviously reasons.
Yeah, no, well, we've needed these all the time. And if you look back to even the 17th century, 18th century, highwaymen used to have this sort of code, because criminal slang was one of the first to be collected ever. In fact, the very first dictionaries were of criminal cant, as it was called. And so highwaymen would, if they bumped into each other in the depth of night, they would say, "The music's paid," meaning, "I'm a fellow highwayman, don't stop me plying my trade." In other words, "I'm fine, I'm kosher, I'm one of yours." And yeah, we definitely still exclude people with our banter today. It's like teenage slang, completely designed to sort of hoodwink the authorities or parents or whoever it is. And in butchers, this is one of the ones I expected secrecy in places like Freemasons, as I mentioned, and spies, magicians even. But butchers up and down the land, in little pockets of... rural England, you'll find something called pig Latin, appropriately. And that is backslang that, you know, is centuries old. And again, it's primarily talking about the customers. They'll use yenom for money, for example, or the hell bat for the table. It's like a giant game of countdown, really, because you have to really decode it. But they swap it around so quickly. Again, yes, that's kind of, this is our group and, you know, it belongs to us. Police, similarly, they, you know, regularly talk about their customers. See, criminals are customers. It's interesting.
We're all taxpayers here, you know.
No, it's true, actually, because even undertakers talk about corpses as customers. So there are lots of different meanings of customers, including criminals that get banged up in the nick, as the police would say. But yes, they too, it's very much a sort of, it is to be kept within the forces, not least the black humour that all these emergency services need in order to get through the day.
It sounds like that was a rich seam for you to mine, actually, the the three emergency service possibly and all their slang seems like you know, as much as builders and football commentators and newspaper people as well. It seems like if you need to get somewhere in a hurry and you kind of, it's strange also, an idea of public accountability means you have to mask your true meaning behind something.
That's really true. And I think within hospitals, for example, you know, all the acronyms that doctors use, they're not apocryphal, they're legendary, aren't they? And so I expected some of them to be apocryphal. But actually, if you go to the junior medics, it's what helps them get through their day, literally, because they will talk about a VIP, a very intoxicated person, or they're always
one and the same, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Teeth apparently is an acronym that does still get used, which is tried everything else, try homeopathy. In other words, you know, we can't do this. They talk about Dr. Google. You know, every patient is armed with what they call hypergoogle-chondria, so which we're all guilty of to some extent. So in doctors, it's a kind of open secret amongst themselves, but never to be replicated in patients' notes, obviously. That is quite exclusive to them, but it is a release mechanism for them. Similarly, within the army, you will find the best banter is the banter, you know, on the ground, not so much in military operations, but amongst themselves. That was the most colourful lingo that I collected, probably.
I bet.
Yeah.
Susie, just something, it was interesting you said about how democratic the English language is and we don't have an academy, I guess, eyes across the channel to France where they're slightly more particular.
Yeah.
You know, we said in the introduction, you know, anyone who's worked in with language as their labour for so many years as you have done, how do you feel about that? Would English be, obviously that democratic process is very positive in many ways, but I guess there are some negatives. Would English be well served, do you think, if there were some kind of body that regulated it, that oversaw it? Or are you happy that, I don't know, you know, the compilation of dictionaries, which is obviously an ongoing process, we still have that process where there's measurements, if you like, of the new words that are coming in, the new idioms. But, you know, what about an English academy? Wouldn't that be a good thing?
I think if you asked anybody who worked on dictionaries, they would scream the same as me, definitely not. Because people for centuries have been saying, you know, English is going downhill. They said it when Shakespeare was around because he was messing around with language. Keats, likewise, was turning nouns into verbs and people hated it. So we've always thought that the golden age was in the past. But if we try to preserve it, as Samuel Johnson did with his dictionary, you know, it's futile. And even he recognised that.
I'm reminded of this scene in Blackadder where he says, it's been most wonderful to meet you with your contrafibularity.
Yeah, exactly. It's just such a brilliant episode. I think in order for English to keep evolving, and it's one of the fastest moving languages in the world, you know, of course there are things that I don't like. I don't like the fact that literally, the figurative sense of literally has now gone into the dictionary. Mm. You know, I don't particularly like that.
Well, this is one of my bugbears, which is like, if something is incorrect for long enough, it becomes correct. Now, you know, you don't have to have an academy to say, well, that's not on. Is that legitimate, or am I just a fuddy-duddy who needs
No, you're not a fuddy-duddy. And you will still find, even though dictionaries are descriptive, they will still say standard English is this. So there will always be a standard and people will always aspire to that because it makes communication more effective and also it makes them sound, you know, cleverer, let's face it.
That's so really what I'm trying to do.
I don't think we'll ever
struggle to do it.
Oh, no, you do. You sound very clever. But I think if we do try and, you know, really, really try and keep hold of it because we think otherwise it is going to deteriorate, we'll actually, you know, do the very opposite and do what we're most scared of. So we don't want it to be like Latin. It's got to be alive and vigorous. And yes, as you say, you know, mistakes will be made, but they always have been, always.
Stylishly so, mostly too. Susie, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you for having me.
And talking us through Dense Modern Tribes, The Secret Languages of Britain, written by Susie Dent. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Monocle Weekly 381. It's gone. It's bit in the dust. Rob, there's an idiom for you.
Yeah.
Fascinating actually hearing from Susie Dent about Britain's literary tribes. Which one are you in?
I don't know which one I'm in actually, because I don't really know. I mean, I suppose there's a bit of
dipping in and out of a few.
Dipping in and out of a few. There's a bit of knowing. There's a bit of a funny language here to the radio studios. There's definitely a separate language upstairs to the putting together of the magazine. And then there is what you think about doing those two jobs simultaneously, and the secret language in which you have to veil your thoughts.
I don't know what you're talking about, Rob.
No, I'm not talking about anything. It's totally fine. I'll tell you what, though. I'm Hank Marvin. That's just a bit of Cockney rhyming, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's definitely...
Sunday lunch, I can smell it wafting. from outside.
There's a roast lunch on the agenda.
I think so. Shall we thank our friends behind the glass? Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, for me,
Robert Bound.
And me, Tom Edwards. There we are then.